From Los Angeles, California, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Wednesday, March 16th, 2016. The FBI and Apple clash over privacy versus security. We'll speak with Shahid Buttar about the story and why the outcome of the clash could be precedent-setting. And Darnell Hunt joins us to discuss the latest Hollywood diversity report. Plus, filmmaker Jen Senko offers perhaps the best explanation for the masses of support behind Donald Trump with her new documentary called The Brainwashing of My Dad. That's coming up after the news. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Federal law enforcement agencies want to hack into the iPhone belonging to the suspected shooters in the massacre that took place in San Bernardino, California last year, and have asked Apple to give them access. Apple has resolutely refused, and polls show that much of the public agrees. President Obama at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas last Friday touched on the current clash between the FBI and Apple.
I anguish a lot over the decisions we make in terms of how to keep this country safe, and I am not interested in overthrowing the values that have made us an exceptional and great nation simply for expediency. But the dangers are real. Maintaining law and order and a civilized society is important. Protecting our kids is important. And so I would just caution against taking an absolutist perspective on this.
That's President Obama speaking at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas last Friday. My guest is Shahid Buttar. He is the Director of Grassroots Advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, formerly the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and a frequent guest here on Uprising. Welcome back to the show, Shahid.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, first, let's talk about the origins of this clash. Essentially, the FBI wants to be able to get into encrypted information on the iPhones belonging to these suspected shooters in San Bernardino. Well, I would have thought that the FBI already had this ability, given how much money the government has spent on trying to spy on people, right?
Well, and it's not clear, quite frankly, that the NSA can't get into the phone. You know, to some extent, it's not unfair to describe this case as presenting, on the one hand, the privacy and security of iPhone users, as well as international human rights and freedom of the press in authoritarian countries where dissidents and gay people and journalists use these devices and the encryption enabled on the device platform to remain safe from authoritarian regimes. You know, there's all those values at stake here that the Bureau in its characterization of the case, both to the court and to the public, has tended to obscure. Right, we're not talking about a single phone here. We're not talking about a single investigation. And while the FBI is claiming that expanding its powers in what I would describe as essentially a power grab, taking advantage of a very unfortunate set of tragic events, this Bureau power grab is an expansion, or would be an expansion, of the Bureau's powers, but it would undermine security. And that's the most important point to recognize here. And other officials in the government also recognize that. That's an important issue that I think the Bureau has tended to try to cover over in all of its public contents.
So the impression that we are getting, that the public gets, is that the FBI just wants to hack into this one phone and Apple isn't complying. But first of all, is that true? And then secondly, is it the case that Apple, in turning over any information to the FBI, would essentially enable it to hack into all iPhones, that just basically showing it how to hack into the one phone would make all of them susceptible?
The answers are no and yes. No, this is absolutely not about one phone. And in fact, prosecutors around the country in Manhattan and Sacramento alone have already disclosed that in those two places, there are hundreds of phones that they are eager to apply the same tool towards should Apple be forced by the court to create this dangerous code that it wants not to create. And the second issue is, yeah, once creating the code, it would undermine the security of the device platform. And here's why. People forget this. And just to take a minute to explain it. For Apple to comply with the judge's order, it has to re-engineer the operating system because the security features it's being asked to disable are built into the operating system. So in developing a new OS, you can't do that on a single machine. It's too complicated, right? So they're going to have to network the development projects across multiple computers. Once that happens, any code is vulnerable. And it's not just that, it's not just the case that Apple says that it can't protect the code. I mean, realize at the moment online, no one can really protect anything without encryption. I mean, even the federal government was hacked for 6 months by Chinese intelligence agents last year, who basically stole the very private information, including the home addresses and even sensitive personal history of 22 million federal employees. This is including people with security clearance, like CIA agents. And if the FBI and the federal government can't keep safe the home addresses of CIA agents from the Chinese intelligence agencies, there's no reason to think that Apple could keep safe from malicious hackers and, you know, the Iranian, Chinese, and Cuban intelligence agencies what could be the most lucrative code ever created in the history of the internet.
And so Apple's so when people use iPhones, are you saying that the information that we have on our iPhones is far more secure than information on the internet?
Generally speaking, that's a fair statement to make. You know, Apple has increased the security of its devices, responding to the fact that at the moment now 3 million smartphones are stolen a year. And before full disk encryption, when someone stole your phone off the train or out of the cafe or, you know, wherever, it would give them access to everything, what the Supreme Court in 2014 described as the sum total of your private life. It's not just your private communications with your colleagues. It's also, you know, your intimate texts with your life partner, photos you might exchange with that person, your financial transactions and history. These are incredibly not just sensitive things that can be used to quell people into silence. That is a First Amendment problem. But this can lend itself to identity theft. I mean, we were talking about the security of users, not just online, but your security from things like identity theft or your security from things like blackmail. Right? These are real issues that full disk encryption protects us from. Encryption makes us safe. And the way the FBI would like people to understand this is encryption blinds the government agencies. But the fact of the matter is, and multiple reports have confirmed this, that the agencies aren't going dark. They're gaining access to entirely new forms of potential surveillance data, everything from, you know, when you talk about the smart cars and driverless cars, I mean, wherever you go will be transparent to the government in that arena. You know, the smart fridge that orders milk, it will be, and its data streams are available to the government to look literally into your stomach, right? So the government's gaining new kinds of data access at the same time that the Bureau, uniquely among the federal agencies, is trying to draw a line in the sand here. And it's worth noting, I alluded to this before, but just to make clear for your listeners, that there's a lot of dissent even within the government over the FBI's position. And it's striking that the NSA has not publicly reinforced the Bureau. In fact, the former head of the NSA, who also at one point led the CIA, that's Michael Hayden. This is not someone who I usually cite approvingly, given the litany of abuses that those agencies have committed against the American people and others. But what he said is that the FBI has it wrong here. That encryption ensures herd immunity, that it ensures that the infrastructure can be safe, and that allowing...
Kind of herd immunity, kind of like vaccinations. So yeah. You're saying that the NSA is taking a better position on this than the FBI?
Unofficially. I mean, the NSA has not spoken in its official capacity, and Hayden is a former NSA director, but you know, government agencies and their institutional cultures do this a lot, right? You trot out a former official when you don't want to take an official position against a partner agency. And it is fair to say that the intelligence arena, you know, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the NCTC, the litany of other government agencies that are engaged in domestic and other forms of surveillance, those agencies fight with each other as much, you know, to contend for who has more power, as much as they are concerned about national security. And this could be described as a turf war among federal agencies.
Do you think the FBI made a sort of a faux pas or just you made a big mistake in going public with this clash over Apple, because they might have imagined that the horrific nature of the massacre in San Bernardino might push enough of the public to say, all right, fine, we will give up some security for privacy for some security. But then it backfired because even Apple, whose CEO isn't given to being very public, has, you know, gone on talk shows saying, no way, they're not going to do this. There was a Wall Street Journal poll that showed that a majority of the public backs Apple on this. And yes. So the FBI's ploy seems to have backfired.
I think it's right to describe it as a ploy. I mean, people forget that it was just a week before the FBI sought the judicial orders that are controversial in San Bernardino, just a week before, appearing before that court in an ex parte hearing where the court didn't get to hear the other side. The FBI director was on Capitol Hill trying to make the case that the FBI is going dark in the face of encrypted devices. So it seems the timing is at least odd, that after having the phone for 2 months, the Bureau would go to court a week after showing up in Congress and being pressed about these questions by multiple members of Congress. I think it's both unfortunate that the FBI would attempt to politicize so unfortunate an issue. And I do think you're right. It is certainly backfiring to the Bureau's interest.
And so what happens now? Can Apple basically be forced by a court to do this? I mean, I'm assuming Apple will fight this and may go all the way to the nation's highest court?
Well, I don't know if we'll have to end up before the nation's highest court. At the moment, the case is still before the court that entered the order. And in the last few weeks, Apple has filed its response to the original order. We at EFF have filed an amicus brief, as have on behalf of dozens of technologists, including the people who invented encryption, trying to explain to the judge, this is how the math works, because no one to this point has closely grappled with that. But several other briefs have gone into the court, and there will be a hearing on March 22nd to assess what the outcome of this stage of the process will be. Should it go against Apple, I do expect some appeals, and from a magistrate order, the first appeal is to the district court, and then the next to the Ninth Circuit. To reach the Supreme Court would take years, and I fully expect that before we get there, Congress will put an end to this by making very clear that encryption keeps us safe. And Congress has said as much through implication by when legislating CALEA, that's the Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Act, many years ago, stopping short of giving the Bureau and other government agencies the power to order companies to intentionally undermine the security of their device platforms. That's the issue, is can the government force a device manufacturer? And in this case, it's Apple, but should it win this case, it could be any manufacturer of software or devices. It would literally make everything insecure and untrustworthy to users. And Congress has declined to give that power in the past.
Right, so this case is so important, not just because so many people own iPhones, but also because it has the power to set a precedent across other devices. Finally, I'm wondering if there is, if you can sort of pinpoint the reason why the public seems to be much more interested in this, issue in terms of protecting privacy than, for example, after Edward Snowden made his revelations about government spying. Is it that people are sort of able to identify much more with this device in their pocket that they rely on so much? Even just in the last, every year our reliance seems to get greater and greater on these smartphones that we carry with us, and so much of our lives is kind of represented in them, and that this just got way too personal for the public.
I certainly hope that people are grappling with this to a deeper extent than they did the Snowden revelations, only because Congress certainly failed ever to finish dealing with the Snowden revelations.
Right. Right?
I mean, we've sort of dealt with the equivalent of a 3 years, let's sweep this under the rug and forget about it. Mm. And I think the public uproar over the device encryption controversy will force Congress to make clear and defend the constitutional values that it has waffled around in the past. You make this point that people have the cell phone with them and have an intimate relationship with their phones that perhaps they lacked with the subjects at issue in the Snowden revelations. I feel like in some respect that's a little hard to accept, only because what Snowden revealed entailed domestic spying through so many different vectors. What I think might be the case is that what the Snowden revelations revealed was so big and difficult to grasp that people didn't understand how deeply their own interests were implicated, whereas because this issue is so discreet, it's easier for people to understand. But just to be clear, the Snowden revelations revealed domestic surveillance and dragnet spying that impacts people no less than the encryption controversy at stake today, in some respects even more so, because those are about operations and government programs that are now well established, whereas what we're talking about in the encryption debate is something that would emerge and has yet to emerge. But I think you're right that people are feeling this controversy in a way that perhaps they didn't before.
And also, finally, let's also just step back and point out the fact that government officials like to think of spying and surveillance on the public as the most important way to tackle terrorism, right? We have terrorism because we can't get into iPhones. No, we have terrorism because we've got a terrible foreign policy that generates, you know, a very, very vast hatred against the United States for all the destruction we've wrought in the Middle East. And we lose sight of that. I mean, you know, if we really want to tackle terrorism, we should be doing it at its root cause, right?
It's not a crazy thing to suggest. And another point to make, and I think you insinuated this, if mass surveillance actually worked, we wouldn't have this problem,
right?
I mean, it doesn't actually keep us safe in the same way that compromising encryption doesn't actually make us any more safe. I mean, people confuse what security entails, and I think you're observing that now.
Yeah, Shahid, always a pleasure to have you on. Give out a website for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Folks can learn more at www.eff.org.
We'll post a link to our site later today. Thank you, as always, Shahid.
You're so kind. Keep up the good work, sister.
Thank you so much. My guest is Shahid Buttar. He is the Director of Grassroots Advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and a frequent guest on Uprising. Again, that website is eff.org. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Back in just a moment. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. As the brouhaha over the Oscars being so white starts to die out, one wonders if the discussion on diversity in film will come up only once a year. Ensuring fair representation of people of color and women requires year-round effort. And one of the institutions holding Hollywood's feet to the fire is the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA, which issues a yearly report on the industry. My guest is Darnell Hunt. He is a professor of sociology and African American studies and the chair of the sociology department and director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center at UCLA. And he now joins me to discuss the third and latest report on diversity in Hollywood. Welcome to Uprising, Darnell.
Hi, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, before we dig into the report, let's begin with what seems like some good news. I'm assuming you saw the effort by the white film director J.J. Abrams, who's announced hiring quotas for his production company, Bad Robot. According to The Guardian, quote, Bad Robot will reportedly work with its agency partner, CAA, and studios Warner Brothers and Paramount to ensure women and minorities are submitted for writing, directing, and acting jobs for the company in direct proportion to their representation among the U.S. population. What do you make of this?
Well, it's great news. I mean, I think there needs to be more of this. I commend J.J. Abrams for making this step. I mean, it's something we've been calling for years. Someone had to do it, and you know, he's a big enough name in the industry. Maybe he'll convince his peers that this is the right thing to do to basically be in the America business.
And he directed the new Star Wars film, which broke from the sort of standard industry practice by having a very diverse cast, a cast that was so diverse that it even caused some controversy among white supremacists last year.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very unfortunate. These views, where people, have a hard time with reflecting America because that's not what they are accustomed to. I mean, it's unfortunately a reflection of a very privileged position that denies, where America is going in terms of our diversity.
So let's talk about the report that your organization, your institution issues. I understand that this is the third such report, and it looks at the top 200 films and TV shows in a given period. And while there were some arenas in which women and people of color gained ground, there were also some losses. Tell us about the report itself, first of all, and what you looked at.
Yeah, so this is the third installment in the series. We released the first report in 2014, and then we did a follow-up in 2015, and of course this year's report. And so the goal of the report is to chart over time progress or the lack thereof. Most of what we've known about the industry historically has been rather anecdotal. There's really never been a comprehensive report that tried to connect the dots over time across the various arenas. So we look at pretty much everything. We look at the top 200 films ranked by box office. We look at pretty much everything in TV. And this year was 1,146 TV shows across broadcast, cable, and digital platforms. And what we're really trying to do is connect sort of diversity or the lack thereof to the bottom line. That is to say, to explore the degree to which diversity actually sells. As a sociologist, I'm more interested in the images and the impact the images have on society and the way we see each other. But that moral argument is not something that's moved the industry. The industry is much more concerned with the bottom line. And so if we can show profitability, if we can show that indeed increasingly diverse audiences want diverse content, I think we have a much better chance of spurring people like the J.J. Abrams of the world to actually, make the types of choices they need to make to move this industry into the 21st century.
I want to focus on what you just said, that that you basically have America's increasingly diverse audience preferring diverse films. And honestly, I'm so sick of films that are centered on only whites that I just won't go see them anymore. Yeah, I mean, I just refuse to watch TV shows where there's not a single person of color in a lead role. And I imagine that even white audiences might be getting sick of seeing such homogeneity on their screens. The world just doesn't look like that.
No, you're exactly right. So one of the things we do for film, of course, this year for the first year, we actually had rent track data that surveys ticket buyers as they're leaving the theater to get a sense of who the audiences are. And what we found was that the number one film in 2014 was Transformers: Age of Extinction, made $1.1 billion globally. People of color were responsible for 60% of those ticket sales. In fact, of the top 10 films ranked by box office that year, people of color bought most of the tickets for four of them. So what we're finding is a consistent pattern. We found this 3 years running now. The films that on average tend to look like American society in terms of their diversity receive the highest box office. And the same thing is true in television. TV shows that tend to be more diverse on average have the highest ratings. And this is not only for households of color, we also found this with white households that, as you said earlier, they also want to see something that rings true, that looks like the world that's around them.
Now, is there a difference that you found in cable versus broadcast, online shows, versus the sort of traditional outlets, film versus television, where women and people of color are concerned?
Well, there is a pecking order, so to speak, in terms of which platforms are the best. So across the board, film is the worst. Film is just pretty horrendous. In every arena, in front of the camera, behind the camera, people of color and women are underrepresented. Women particularly get slammed as directors in film. I mean, the single worst statistic in our study, and this has been true for a couple of years now, is women directors who are underrepresented by a factor of nearly 12-1 among directors. And so it's one of the reasons why, Ava DuVernay, a couple of years ago when she was snubbed by the Academy, wasn't even nominated as a director. I mean, first of all, a woman director is very rare, and a woman of color is almost unheard of to direct a critically acclaimed film. And the fact that she was acknowledged by the Directors Guild, but not even nominated by the Screen Actors Guild, by the Film Academy, was quite egregious. So yeah, and then if you look at television, Broadcast tends to be a little bit better than cable only because broadcast is trying to reach the largest audience possible. They're not usually niche marketing in the same way that some cable networks are. So, for example, in cable, you have El Rey Network that targets Latinos. You have TV1, BET, Oprah Winfrey Network that, you know, tend to skew African-American. Oprah Winfrey also women. Lifetime for women. For those reasons, the numbers are a little different in cable. Women actually do a little bit worse overall in cable than they do in broadcast. And people of color actually do a little bit better in cable than they do in broadcast. So it's a mixed game. But across the board, film is the worst, followed by broadcast, and then cable.
Have there been gains made in broadcast television? I mean, we have, you know, say a director like Shonda Rhimes, who is so prolific, who is just, you know, one show after another, and they're hit shows. You know, is she still as rare as one might imagine as a female and a person of color in this industry for broadcast?
Yeah, I mean, she is quite a rarity. I mean, you know, the study we're talking about this year looks at 2013-14, so we're about a year and a half behind, only because it takes so long to collect all this data. And there have been some things that happened in the last 2 years. I mean, the emergence of Empire, for example, which isn't captured in our study, but clearly has made a huge impact. I mean, it's the biggest, you know, television debut probably in 20 years. So, you know, I expect when we do next year's study that we'll see a little bump because of a show like that. But across the board, these shows are still outliers. They're still exceptions to the rule. Most shows don't look like Shonda Rhimes shows or Empire. So, yeah, I mean, I think if we talk about, you know, across all 1,146 shows, the shows that are, you know, great examples of diversity, with diversity in front of the camera, behind the camera, you know, are relatively rare still, unfortunately.
So I'm glad you brought up the issue of directors and writers, especially. I mean, is it true, at least, you know, we've seen with directors like Ava DuVernay and Shonda Rhimes that they tend to do shows that are more diverse. But is it generally true that if you have more people of color and women writing scripts, directing films and TV shows, that we are likely to get greater diversity simply by virtue of having that representation behind the camera?
Well, absolutely. And the point we make throughout our report series is actually more important to focus on what's happening behind the camera than in front of it. In some cases, you can have window dressing where, and this is what the industry has typically done, whenever it is critiqued, they'll hastily throw a couple of more faces in front of the camera. And unfortunately, those faces are usually just there to support the lead who remains white, who is often male, and it's never their story. And what we're talking about is whose stories are we telling? In a diverse society, people watching television want to see their own stories. They want to see people who look like them, people they can relate to, experiences that resonate with their own. And that only happens if you have diversity behind the camera, the people in the writer's room, the people who are pitching the basic concept for a show or for a movie, the person who's writing the script for a movie. These people need to be women and people of color as well. And that's really the great frontier where we haven't made quite as much progress as we have in front of the camera.
And even in the meantime, though, do you think that white writers and directors are feeling the pressure today to write shows that are more diverse? I mean, there's a new show coming out called Underground about the underground slave revolts. And I believe at least one of the writers is white, Joe Pakaski, you know, very sort of liberal leaning writer and director.
Sure.
And so do you feel that white writers and directors are feeling the pressure, realizing that the scrutiny of reports like yours, like the social media trend, hashtag #OscarSoWhite, is putting them on notice?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, in the last couple of years, I mean, you know, 2 years running now with the Oscars and no nominations for people of color in the major actor categories, it's kind of shined a spotlight on something we've been talking about for generations. The other thing that's new is that demographically, what they're doing or business as usual in the industry is really unsustainable. I mean, people of color are about 40% of the population now, and we're increasing you know, that share about 0.5% a year. So if you do the math, 10 years, that's another 5%. Another 10 years, that's another 5%. And guess what? We're at majority-minority status. We also know that people of color buy more movie tickets, particularly Latinos. And African-Americans and Latinos watch more television. So at some point, you're losing the audience and you're leaving billions on the table. And that's the argument we're making by not diversifying. Mm-hmm. But it's not enough just to diversify in front of the camera. You also have to do it behind the camera because you have to tell diverse stories. So, yeah, I think that white writers, producers, they're feeling the pressure. The problem is they don't particularly know how to make the type of programming that I think the audience ideally wants.
Right. What, I mean, a white writer writing a dialogue for a person of color is not, you know, is not able to draw from their own experience.
Well, you know, it's not like, you know, I'm saying that only black people can write for black people, only Latinos can write for Latinos, only women can write for women, et cetera, but you have to have those perspectives in the room so that you can negotiate. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a collaborative industry. I mean, very rarely do people do things individually or solely in this industry. You're always working with other people. And the point we're making is, you know, having more voices in the room, more perspectives in the room will always produce a better product and one that's going to be more in sync with where the audience is. And so I think white, you know, talent, white writers, producers, directors, they're definitely feeling the pressure. In the past, they could get away with just making something from a white point of view. And clearly now, you know, the numbers are beginning to show that this is just not going to be sustainable.
I've been speaking with Darnell Hunt, professor of sociology and African American studies, chair of the sociology department, and director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA. And you can visit uprisingwithsonali.com to find a link to the report that you can directly download. This is Uprising. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Uprising. I am Sonali Kohatkar. The rise of Donald Trump has confounded the country. If one had to describe a typical Trump supporter, it would be a white American man who was angry, very angry. The businessman turned politician seems to be striking such a strong chord in some Americans that it seems unfathomable why so many would back a person who frequently lies, promotes racism, misogyny, and violence. But if you watch Jen Senko's new film, The Brainwashing of My Dad, it doesn't seem terribly surprising. The film is about to be released theatrically, and here is an excerpt from the beginning moments of the documentary.
I had a Kickstarter campaign to raise some money, and before I knew it, people were coming out of the woodwork, contacting me from all over the country, telling me similar stories. And I thought, wow, this is a real phenomenon.
They just drummed into her what they wanted her to hear. She's a completely different person.
My brother became very fact resistant.
My reaction was, who are you and what have you done with my stepfather?
Disjointed existence.
And he was completely changed. He was bitter and angry.
At one point, he threatened to get a bus.
He became challenging. Obsessed.
And she had never been like that.
He was carrying a small pistol.
She was not hateful.
And shot twice.
It broke my heart to see my parents.
Very loving, caring.
I feel I don't really know these people anymore.
I mean, it just goes up as tirades.
I spoke with each one and found we all had one thing in common. Someone close to us became enraged and unreachable after excessively listening to or watching right-wing media. How did this happen?
The great story here for anybody willing to find it and write about it and explain it is this vast right-wing conspiracy.
You've been listening to the opening moments of a documentary called The Brainwashing of My Dad. Filmmaker Jen Senko now joins me. She is the writer, producer, and director of the film. Welcome to Uprising, Jen.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us first about your father so we can set the stage for why you made this documentary. What sort of a person was he before he began watching Fox and listening to Rush Limbaugh? And what sort of person did he become afterwards?
My dad was a very open, outgoing, happy-go-lucky, loving everybody type of person. He was non-judgmental. Both my parents never even gossiped. You know, I would go to other friends' houses and maybe their parents gossiped. My dad would talk to anybody, and, you know, there was never any racism or anything like that in our house. I kind of thought of my parents when the hippie thing came in as like kind of the first hippies in a way. I don't think they thought of themselves that way, but in a way they were, because they were very, very open-minded. And that's how he was before.
And then what happened once he started listening to Rush Limbaugh? You explained in your film that he got a job that basically required him to have a long commute, and a lot of talk radio, I think the majority of talk radio is conservative. Rush Limbaugh is one of the top, I think he is the top talk radio host in the country. So your dad started listening to Rush?
Well, first it started with Bob Grant.
Bob Grant.
Because, yeah, that was in the 80s. And he was openly bombastic, racist, sexist, homophobic radio host. And, you know, that was kind of like the first style of radio host. And then we started noticing changes. And I kind of saw the writing on the wall, and I would see things or experience things, and then that my dad would do that would be completely antithetical to what he used to be. And then finally he started listening to Rush Limbaugh, and it was just crazy. I mean, like one time he picked me up in a car, and this is in the movie. I was at the bus station, and we drove past a Hooters, and he just started ranting about feminists. Like not wanting
feminazis, women. Right? That's the term that the right wing likes to call feminists, feminazis, and that's what Rush uses.
Yeah, Rush used that term. Don't like women with their breasts hanging out working at Hooters. And I said to him, "Well, Dad, maybe the feminists have a point." And he just got so furious with me and so red in the face, angry, and threatened to pull the car over and have me hitchhike home. And this was not the dad I knew.
And so your father started becoming a very angry person. Did the rest of your family notice this?
Oh, yes. Very, very much so. It became agonizing, really, for the rest of the family, because once emailing came in, then he was a great target for every right-wing, far-right group there was, from the Heritage Foundation to the NRA, even though he was never a hunter or, even in the Army in World War II, he was a medic. But he would start emailing us every far-right, angry, hating Democrats email he could. And he we would ask him to stop. We'd say we don't agree. We felt that some of it was definitely false. And he just kept sending it. He was very angry about it. And finally, we had to, some of us blocked him. Me and my brothers both had to block him. So it's very disturbing.
What happened when you started making the film? So you set out to try to figure out what happened to your father, how this person who was a nice person at one time became an angry person. You started getting, as the clip that we played showed, you started getting people from all over the country when you had your crowdfunding campaign saying that they had had similar experiences with their loved ones. And I'm wondering, how many Americans are there out there who've sort of lost their loved ones to Fox, if you will? And I use a language that sounds like we're talking about a cult, because that's kind of how people begin behaving, right? When they get sucked into this right-wing media machine.
Yes, it's very cult-like. A lot of similarities.
So you started hearing from all these people. Tell us about that.
Okay, so we had a Kickstarter campaign early on, and we had 947 backers, and some of them just started emailing me every day saying, "Oh my God, thank you so much for doing this, and this happened to my dad or my mom or my brother or my sister, you know, or my whole family, and I don't recognize them anymore, and they're always angry, and we can't speak about anything without arguing. You know, you can't even talk about the weather because then global warming comes up and they don't agree." And you know, I like became like a therapist for so many people. I just felt so bad for them, but at the same time, they were comforted. I was comforted because we knew we weren't alone, that it wasn't just happening to us. And that's what made me realize that this was a phenomenon and a lot more dangerous than I even suspected.
So you then basically began this journey once you got your funding. Over several years, you talked to people like David Brock, who founded Media Matters, Jeff Cohen, the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Noam Chomsky, who, of course, wrote the Manufacturing Consent. And so what did you learn about the way in which these right-wing media are created? You have a quote in your film about Hillary Clinton calling it a right-wing conspiracy, but the picture that you paint, which sounds really kind of out there, but the picture that you paint in your film does kind of sound like a conspiracy. It's this infrastructure that the right has spent many years building, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, conspiracies happen. I mean, I believe people walked on the moon. It just, you know.
This one has plenty of documentation, this conspiracy.
That's right. You know, this was a vast right-wing conspiracy. I don't usually ascribe to them, but I don't know how much history you want me to give, but it started back in 1964. It was sort of a boomerang effect after Goldwater lost to Johnson in a landslide. They thought, like, well, gee, you know, what do we do about this? You know, nobody wants to be a conservative. And so one of the ways that they struck back was through the media. And they knew that they had to do two things. One was paint the media as liberal and biased. And then the other thing was develop their own media. You know, and then along the way, there were other little things that were going in that same direction, you know, like Roger Ailes, who wrote a memo kind of outlining, this was early on, this was in 1970, like how you should create a media for the GOP that would just espouse its views. And he wrote, you know, in the memo, like, the thinking is done for you and people are lazy. And
he worked closely with Nixon, right?
Oh, yeah.
He helped him win the election.
Yes, he was Nixon's television advisor because he had seen how poorly he had done when he was with Kennedy. And, you know, he was sweaty and, you know, shifty-eyed. And, you know, Kennedy was, like, cool, calm, collected, and handsome. So he approached Nixon and said, look, you know, you gotta like, get with this TV thing. And Nixon didn't take it seriously at first, you know, but he did. He groomed him and he taught him how to speak in snappy one-liners and to appeal to average people, because, you know, it was obvious that he was representing very like corporations and wealthy people. And, you know, we told him like how to appeal to the average guy. And I mean, he didn't create the Southern effect.
Strategy.
So the Southern strategy, thank you. But, you know, he did help him become
right.
much more appealing.
And, of course, then Roger Ailes went on to run Fox News. I'm speaking with Jen Senko. She's the writer, producer, and director of the film The Brainwashing of My Dad. And the word brainwashing is really strong, but you make a pretty compelling case in your film. I want to play for our audience another clip from the documentary film The Brainwashing of My Dad. This is a film, by the way, that's about to be theatrically released. And here's another excerpt.
Branding is about creating an image that will stick in the mind. Whether that image created is accurate or not doesn't matter. Democrats, liberals, and progressives are branded as big government spenders, dishonest, America-hating elitists who are all atheists who hate Christmas and are soft on crime and weak on defense. They've branded the media as liberal, so much so that it's taken for granted that it's true.
One catchphrase mm-hmm. that I hear over and over mm-hmm. again is liberal media.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear your dad?
All the time. I heard him use the term liberal media all the time. He'd be like, oh, you can't listen to liberal media. As if there was no such thing as the conservative media.
If you analyze news coverage, as FAIR has done, you find that the news tilts a little bit to the right. It's sort of center-right. Republicans usually outnumber Democrats. It's just pure math. And then people say, well, why do so many people believe the liberal media myth? If you keep handing opinion-shaping power to right-wingers who don't have evidence to yell about, oh, liberals, the liberals, the liberals, the liberals who dominate, well, it's gonna have some traction.
The liberal media.
Liberal media.
Liberal bias.
Liberal media, folks.
Liberal press.
It is the liberal media.
And that is another excerpt from the documentary, The Brainwashing of My Dad, by filmmaker Jen Senko. And she literally made this film to try to understand what happened to her father when he went on an almost exclusive diet of right-wing media. Well, the timing of your film, Jen, is very appropriate. I'm guessing that having made this film, you are not surprised at all by the phenomenon of Donald Trump and all of his supporters, are you?
No, and I wonder why more people in the media don't connect the dots. Like, I'm just an average person, you know, why can I connect the dots and they can't connect the dots? I mean, some do, but really pretty much, you know, like they'll wonder like, well, why is it that the Christian, Donald Trump is appealing to the Christian right? And well, it's because this, you know, far right media, like Fox News and, you know, the hate radio, they claim to be the ones, they put the stake in the ground and said, you know, we're the religious ones, we're the true Christians, we're the true patriots, those Democrats and liberals and, you know, progressives, they're not patriotic and they hate America and they hate religion, they hate Christianity. So of course, you know, the Christian right also, you know, they're voting on issues, they're going to side with him. But so, yeah, no, I'm not surprised at all. It's like this media created Donald Trump and his followers. And, you know, it's like now they kind of created a monster.
And you point out in your film that once people are sucked into this cult of the right-wing media, facts don't matter. Like, Donald Trump can lie, and he does lie all the time. He can say whatever he wants to say. He can sort of, openly say what people wish they could openly say and what Fox News does openly say. But it's almost as though you basically can't really tackle this phenomenon with reasonable, rational discussion and discourse. And the only way to kind of staunch this flow into the American public is to stop, you know, them from watching Fox, right? I mean, did your dad ever stop watching Fox?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what happened? Did he turn back to his normal self?
Well, I'd be telling the end of the movie, and I really shouldn't.
people can watch the film to find out. Tell us where the film. The film is opening theatrically March 18th. I understand in New York and Los Angeles and some other markets.
Yes, some other markets, and they can find out where on the website www.thebrainwashingofmydad.com. We'll have all the places listed that it's screening, and then also where they can find it on VOD.
So it'll also be available on video on demand. And we'll post all of that information to our website later today. Again, the website of the film is thebrainwashingofmydad.com. Jen, best of luck to you. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sonali. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
My guest has been Jen Senko. She is the writer, producer, and director of the documentary The Brainwashing of My Dad. Again, that website is thebrainwashingofmydad.com. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Our theme music is by Quetzal. You can like us at facebook.com/uprisingradio. Follow us at twitter.com/uprisingradio. And our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. I'm your host, executive producer, and audio engineer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.